Good evening and welcome to Inside Motorsport.
From the racetracks around Australia, here's Inside Motorsport.
Hello, I'm Craig Revell.
I'm Colin Ford.
And I'm Peter Norton. Welcome to this week's episode of Inside Motorsport.
Colin McRae is trying to make it 3 wins from his last 3 starts in the Acropolis Rally. At the end of leg 2, McRae leads his Ford teammate Carlos Sainz. In 3rd place, another Brit, Richard Burns, having another strong performance. Greg Strange is at the Acropolis Rally and sends this report.
McRae led all day, but that lead was steadily whittled away as both Carlos Sainz and Richard Burns attacked. McRae was definitely slowed by the gravel on the road. Being first on the stages put him at a disadvantage, and he'll have the same problem when competition resumes tomorrow. The Scot leads his Ford teammate Carlos Sainz by 9.8 seconds. Ford want a 1-2 for maximum points in the Manufacturers' Championship, but there's no way they could order their drivers to drive for position as they did here last year. It's unlikely either driver would accept it, but Richard Burns in 3rd, 14.8 seconds off the lead, is just too close. He's nail-biting, just the kind of situation all fans want. 7 stages left, and it's between these 3.
That was the overnight news in the Acropolis Rally as of the end of Leg 2, but they've been racing already this morning. At the track is Greg Strange.
And all sorts of drama here in the past hour. England's Richard Burns on the charge in his Subaru, carving into Scotland's Colin McRae's lead, but coming unstuck. His Impreza car leaving the track, it seems. We're still waiting final confirmation on that, but he's way, way behind, a full 3 minutes now off the pace and back in 7th place. Forgive me, but a real Greek tragedy for the English driver who had a genuine chance to win here. Colin McRae now leads by 14.8 seconds from his fourth teammate Carlos Sainz of Spain, with Petter Solberg of Norway in 3rd for Subaru, 57.8 seconds behind. Last year, Ford imposed team orders when they were leading 1-2 here, but they say no orders this time. Solberg is still a threat, and Ford wants maximum points in the Manufacturers' Championship.
Coming around the Ford chicane, the pace car pulls off, the green flag is waved, it's foot to the floor for on pole position. Lauren Aiello, Frank Beeler is alongside of him. They're side by side, and just going into the lead is Lauren Aiello, but going right with him is the champion, Richard Porter, as they sweep through the Dunlop curve and go up towards the exit. It's the Lauren Aiello for pole position, and it's Jan Lammers who's moved up into 2nd place. The Jan is on a charge right from the word go. Jan Lammers is up into 2nd place. Aiello leads. In 3rd place is Frank Beeler. In 4th place is Ralph Kellenes in the champion racing car. He's trying to make up ground and also having a very good start there with number 16 Olivia Beretta in the Chrysler Mopa. So these normally aspirated engines going very well indeed as they come up towards Chet Rouge's job.
Yes, and through Chet Rouge it looks like Beretta's gone through and taken up a position there, got a very, very good run down into the corner and has disposed of one of the Audis, I believe. Yes, he has, and has got himself up into 3rd position. The Gulf Audi, there we go, there's 10 francs in the swear box straight away. The Gulf Audi has also looked like it's made a pretty good start, and down towards the first chicane, the Virage Motorola, he could well be in a position to make a dive pass through and make up a position on the Bentley threat.
Okay. The Le Mans 24 Hours race is on once again in France, and for this update, we'll go to Joe Parsons.
Well, 17 and a half hours gone. It's still on Audi 1-2 with Frank Beeler, Emanuele Pirro and Tom Christensen on four to repeat their win of last year and become the 1st drivers to take back-to-back victories here since 1987. They're 3 laps ahead of the 2nd factory car, driven by Laurence Aiello, Rinaldo Capello and Christian Pescatori. The one surviving Bentley, of which Leisinger, Andy Wallace and Eric van der Poel is 3rd, 11 laps down on the leaders, exceeding expectations on their return to Le Mans after a 71-year absence. For Martin Brundle, Stefan Ortelli, Guy Smith Bentley expired after 4.5 hours. There's a close battle for 4th place, with 1 lap separating the Chrysler of Olivier Beretta, Carl Wendlinger and Pedro Lamy from the Courage Peugeot of Jean-Christophe Bouillon, Sébastien Bourdais and Laurent Redon. The rain is holding off, but it's still very overcast. 17 and a half hours gone at Le Mans. It's Audi, Bentley.
The rain has certainly come down at Le Mans this year. Rinaldo Capello, at about the 6-hour mark, spoke about his thoughts on how hard it was to do a driving stint in those sort of conditions.
Yeah, I think it's crazy. It's really crazy to race in this condition, because the only corner where I could push a little bit were at the Porsche corner. It means the only corner where the asphalt is quite good, like a normal circuit. I cannot go flat on the straight. I have just to play with the throttle. I go 50%. I was using 50% of the power of the car. Many times I lost the car on the straight. If I'm here and I didn't crash the car on the straight, it's just because I was lucky, because I lost the car many, many times, and fortunately nothing happened. But it's very crazy to race in this condition. I could not see nothing. I had to drive with the helmet open, with the visor open, and it's a disaster. It was like driving with somebody with a stone in your eyes, because it's so strong, the water in your eyes, that when the feet is high.
This is a good way to spend your birthday, Dindo.
I hope that after midnight the weather will change, because like this is absolutely crazy.
The Indy Racing League moved on to its next stop on the Northern Lights Tour. It was the Casino Magic 500 at the Texas Motor Speedway. Kart wouldn't race there a few months ago, but the IRL had no problem in putting on a fantastic race, as Mike King reports.
And the fifth stop on the 2001 Indy Racing Northern Lights Series calendar will be won by Scott Sharp under a yellow.
Yeah, Mikey, we're talking about, you know, Scott Sharp had everything going for him. The month of May looked like it could have been a super month. He would have done good if he had only won the race. It would have been a perfect month. But that just shows you have to go into these races with an open mind. You just have to do your best with your testing, your homework, your meetings, your preparation, and just your whole operations can be right on target, and you just might not have that luck you need.
So Scott Sharp being led down the front straight by the Oldsmobile Aurora pace car, driven by Johnny Rutherford, will take the checkers and the yellow as they wave simultaneously. And look at this, the crowd still on its feet applauding Scott Sharp, the winner. A lot of flashbulbs capturing this finish despite the fact that it's under yellow. We are being told that we've had six yellows tonight for 42 laps. And unfortunately, the final laps of this race are run under a yellow flag. So here's your top five. Scott Sharp, the winner of the Casino Magic 500, his second win at Texas Motor Speedway in our last three visits here.
I'm a very spiritual person, and I didn't quite understand why that had to happen that way, and I still don't. But my faith didn't waver, and I just put my trust in the man upstairs and said, it'll work out when the time's right. And today, he guided me the whole way through that race, man. I was less than inches apart from people, and obviously that last spell, we were able to miss that, so killer.
Well, I mean, Eddie had his great runs today. Greg has his great runs at times. Sam, everybody else, you guys were just steady all day long.
That's really what we chose to do, you know. Just run along really well and stay in the game, not use up the car. The crew, what can I say about the Delphi guys? They gave me an unbelievable ass pit stop. That really probably won us the race, because it put us in position to be in the command and dictate how we wanted to run things.
Equally in terms of physically and mentally exhausting a race like this?
Not quite as bad as last year, really. Maybe I'm in better shape.
Sam Hornish Jr., what a great night for the points leader as he comes up with a big second-place finish. That's worth a lot of points, and he's going to be very happy with that.
Yeah. I didn't want to become part of a wreck, so I'm pretty glad I just kind of held my own and stayed back there. We didn't have a car that was, you know, capable to win tonight, but that shows what a true championship team does, is go out there, work together. The guys did an awesome job in the pits, got me in and out. Central Panther crew works real hard at that, and we just went out there and did the best that we could do and got a second place finish.
Felipe Giafone, look at this guy. This is his career best finish here tonight, JP. And, you know, let's face it, when it comes to racing, luck plays a big part of it. And he goes from a fifth or sixth place finish to a third place finish with this caution.
Yeah, and the guy is, we talked earlier about him maybe being polished, but he started toward the back, and he really had it together, did his game plan just right, stayed on target, and stayed out of trouble, which is the main thing for a rookie season or even the second year. But this was an incredible race, incredible all night.
And in other news internationally this week in motorsport, Jackie Stewart has been awarded a knighthood in the Queen's Birthday Honours List. The former Grand Prix driver and team owner becomes the third post-war racing driver to become a knight, following in the footsteps of Stirling Moss and Jack Brabham. The 63-year-old Scottish driver won 27 of his 99 Grand Prix that he contested and is a triple world champion, taking the Formula One title in 1969, 1971 and 1973. Jackie Stewart just spoke to the BBC immediately after the news about his knighthood.
Well, I got a letter which had in fact gone missing, and I understand it was about 3 weeks ago that I heard that it might happen and that this might be proposed to Her Majesty from the Prime Minister's office. but I actually heard officially that I was being given the knighthood, I think at 12:03 lunchtime today.
And how does one feel to be a knight?
Well, I'm very proud. I'm very proud that if you like, my motor racing career has been recognised, and it's been 28 years since I drove a racing car in anger. So I suppose I hope that my business world has been recognised at the same time. And of course, I had such a lot of help in my motor racing from Ken Tyrrell, who I gained most of my success with, to all the mechanics and engineers that I race with. So it's nice that that's now been recognised in the fullest sense. And of course, for my family, for Helen, for Paul and Mark, and our children, and particularly Helen, who's probably, it's nicer for her reason than me perhaps, because, you know, she's been a great wife, nearly 39 years, and a great mother and a great homemaker. So for them, I'm thrilled. And then in addition to that, I suppose, you know, all the other things that's happened in my life since then, with dyslexia and all the other things I do, so I'm very proud.
Honours like this, at all important to you, or had they passed you by, would you have not really minded?
No, it's an important thing in anybody's life. You know, when you're given a knighthood and recognised in that way by the Queen and by the country, I think it's wrong for anyone to suggest that they're not proud or they're not pleased with such a recognition. My motor racing career, it's been very nice, but this, I think, is more important. I mean, no world championship would match up.
As you say, it's been a while since you were racing. 1973 is when you retired. What is it, do you think, that keeps the name Jackie Stewart so prominent in motor racing and in general circles?
I don't know. I have no idea. You're a better judge of that than I am. I'm always surprised either at the recognition of the name or the recognition of myself. It's somehow or other been kept alive, I suppose, by many of the companies that I've been associated with and have used me as positively as possible within their own organisations and beyond, through media, television, print, etc. So I think probably that's had a lot to do with it.
Is it something you always hoped would come along at some stage?
Well, for some years now, people have been always saying, when are you going to get this or when are you going to get that? And, you know it's there. Somewhere, and it may or may not be given, recognised or acknowledged. So you never could take a thing like that for granted. You know, if it comes your way, and many sportsmen have enjoyed that privilege, and I'm sure they felt just as strongly about it and as pleased as I.
Well, it is a great honour, but when you look back over your career and your life, what are the other great honours that stand out for you?
Well, winning the World Championship three times, of course, and many of the individual Grand Prix races that I've won. I think one of the biggest things has been setting up the Stewart Ford Grand Prix team with my son Paul, and see it succeed so quickly within 31 months, winning a race and getting fourth in the World Championship of Constructors. That was a big thing. To do it as a family unit was wonderful. But lots of other things. I mean, the motor racing is fine, but you know, there's so short-lived successes when you're in sport. It's sort of, you're only as good as your last success. In business, I've enjoyed that challenge too. But I've been very privileged in my life, and I've been, you know, I've had terrific people around me, great people, and that's what makes it. You can never do these things on your own. And I've been blessed by having very strong and reliable people beside me.
Well, it is with a heavy heart that we have to say that Frank Fleetenbrewer, a legend not only in the United States Speedway circles, but here in Australia and New Zealand, did see some great racing throughout the 50s and 60s of that great driver who, certainly stayed around Speedway for quite some time, as becoming one of the most famous photographers involved in motorsport. And it is sad news that we hear he passed away last Saturday. Joining me on the line is the Chief Historian from the Vintage and Veteran Speed Car Association of New South Wales. And Bill, he was a very fondly remembered man right throughout his whole racing career, and then into his later life when he became a guest speaker only recently up in Queensland.
on how his life in racing had come about.
Yeah, that's correct, Craig. Good evening. It's very sad news. He was both respected and admired by everyone right around the world. Raced in the USA, raced in New Zealand and Australia with great distinction. And it's a very sad occasion that we find that he's passed on. But then the man lived to 94 years of age, so fantastic innings, I guess. Considering what these drivers went through, I mean, to live to 94 was, I guess, for him was a bonus.
He was racing in a time where racing drivers were as expendable as the parts on their car, and certainly went through the rough and tumble of motorsport and saw a lot of his friends not come out the other side.
That's right, Craig. He actually started his career in New Zealand, although he was always known as an American, but started his racing career in 1938-39 season, the second year that appeared in that country. And it wasn't long before he went to the States the following year with George Beavis from Victoria, and sharpened his skills on the circuits in America. Won three New Zealand championships in 1939-40, 40-41, and again after the war, 46-47. He won everything from 9-lap feature races in this country to 250-lap races in the United States, racing at the famous Gilmore Stadium in Los Angeles, Balboa Stadium. He raced in Atlantic City, a just unbelievable talented driver. And took on the greats of the sport in America in a V860. Never drove anything except a V860, Craig. And he had to compete against the likes of some of the greats of the sport over there in Offenhauser. So, you know, he did it exceptionally well.
He was, right throughout those years, always one of the fiercest competitors, which is actually how they coined his name. He was seen as a bit of a devil.
Well, yeah, that's right. He was just a phenomenal guy. They reckon he drove like the devil. That's one reason why he was nicknamed, and plus the fact that he painted the devil on his first midget in New Zealand, number 72. Four-cylinder Chevrolet powered too, by the way. So he just didn't start off with something exclusive and high speed. It was just a basic four-cylinder Chev motor.
He is coming back to Australia to be buried because his family is split right throughout the three countries that he did race in, New Zealand, Australia and in the United States.
Yes, Craig, his daughters live in Campbelltown, out Campbelltown way, and they left for the United States last week to bring his body back, and there will be a funeral on this Wednesday in Camden. And I'm sure that there'll be people from right across the country and maybe the world that will come out and pay tribute to this great champion. And the word legend, we often hear of sports commentators and writers criticising for people using that word, but to me it just doesn't seem enough. It's not adequate for this guy because he was really a legend.
It has been a rough year for motorsport fans, particularly of the Speedway variety, with the news that already this year we have lost Dale Earnhardt, Smokey Unick, and now, of course, Frank Satenbrewer.
Well, it just goes to show you sport today is still, you know, not 110% safe. There's always that element of danger, and Dale Earnhardt is proof of this. And, you know, it doesn't matter where we go as far as technology takes us, there's always that risk.
That's right. Well, Bill, I wish we were talking under better circumstances, but thank you very much for the information on Frank Satenbrewer. We do appreciate your time tonight.
Thanks very much, Craig.
Inside Motorsport will return after these messages.
Life can be cruel, not a lot you can do, but it helps if you've got a friend. A friend you can share with, comfort and care with. There's nothing quite like a friend. Nothing quite like a friend.
For more than 70 years, Lorna has played the pipe organ for church and charity. Now she's been given something in return, the Order of Australia and a delightfully affectionate Petrus Therapy companion dog called Ebony. Because of her frail condition, Lorna only occasionally plays the pipe organ these days, but still loves to play piano at home, usually to a highly appreciative audience of one, Ebony. You can help the Guide Dog Association train more Petrus Therapy companion dogs like Ebony by sending your donation today.
Hi, it's Wolfie here. Big breakfast show coming up on Monday morning. The greatest 400 metre runner of all time, Michael Johnson, takes centre stage. He'll be talking about his outstanding career and his farewell performance at the upcoming Goodwill Games in Brisbane. Now, the Tri Nations Netball ends this weekend as well. Give you the lowdown on that, plus a complete wrap of all the weekend's footy results. Join me for Canberra's only sports breakfast show on The Good Sports 103.9 Triple S FM.
Inside Motorsport, from the racetrack to your radio.
Yes, and last weekend the Formula One circus was at Montreal, a circuit that has been described by some people as a little bit boring. We won't say who that is. But naturally enough, it was a result that many people thought we'd see in terms of the number one position name being Schumacher. But it wasn't the Schumacher we thought. It was the younger brother. And this report now comes to us from Jonathan Ledyard of the BBC.
Three races finished, two races won. If only Ralph Schumacher's Williams always worked like a dream. Like Imola in April, it was copybook stuff. While his teammate, Juan Pablo Montoya, was picking himself out of the barriers yet again, Schumacher picked off his brother soon after half distance and never looked back. And who better for the champion to lose to, as the happy family celebrated Formula One's first podium finish for two brothers. Mika Hakkinen's smile returned with his first podium in 10 races, but David Coulthard's mood was as black as the boxes his car was packed into after his engine blew up when lying fourth. It was his first retirement of the season, but it's left him 18 points down in the title race. Kimi Raikkonen's Sauber was fourth, Jean-Alaise's Prost fifth, and Pedro de la Rosa brought home his Jaguar in sixth. Jenson Button and Eddie Irvine barely turned the wheel in anger before dropping out.
In Pocono 500 qualifying, Rudd's no dud. And what about all the talk? This track is up for sale. It's all bullshit. Talking NASCAR, I'm Mark Garrow.
PRN's Garage Pass, brought to you by Team Monte Carlo. Chevy, the cars more champions depend on. 11,987 patches of rubber.
And Team Monte Carlo, Captain Talladega.
481 checkered flags.
That's number 50 for Gordon.
17 manufacturers' championships. No, one team. Team Monte Carlo. The team with the winningest car in NASCAR Winston Cup history.
Woo! They're going to be tough to beat.
Monte Carlo. The cars more champions depend on. Chevy. We'll be there.
Ricky Craven, I guess when you hit that brake pedal, you've got to have a lot of faith in those brake pads.
You've got to be able to race with authority and know that everything underneath you is the very best. And with performance friction, it's never a question.
What about the brakes on your family car?
My wife says they're quieter. And if they're quieter, then it's peace of mind. And my children are more important to me than any one of those 15 race cars I have.
Performance Friction Carbon Metallic. Available at AutoZone.
In qualifying here at Pocono, Ricky Rudd was quite the stud. The Texaco Taurus driver was almost 2 miles per hour quicker than anybody else.
It's pretty impressive. It's been fast since we unloaded, and it's continued to be fast through qualifying. We just hope that we don't lose the momentum when we start the race, because it's been a good week for us so far.
In capturing the top spot, Rudd ran 170.503 miles per hour. Next closest, Sterling Marlin at 168.811. It was Rudd's first pole at Pocono and the first in 2001. Ken Schrader qualified third with Tony Stewart and Mark Martin rounding out the top five. 6-10, Dale Earnhardt Jr., Johnny Benson, Jeff Burton, Jeremy Mayfield, and Dale Jarrett. 11th on the grid, Brett Bodine, followed by Todd Bodine, Casey Atwood, and Jeff Gordon goes off 14th as he looks for his third straight win.
I know anything's possible with this team. I tell you, they're awesome. I'm just happy to be driving the 24 DuPont Chevrolet right now, because that sucker's got it all.
Taking Mike Wallace's place, Ted Musgrave was 15th. The rest of the top 20, Rusty Wallace, Michael Waltrip, Bobby Labonte, Kevin Harvick, and John Andretti. Since we're racing here at Pocono this weekend, garage gossip, track owner Joe Mattioli is about to sell out, has resurfaced again. Mattioli angrily denied reports he had accepted a $110 million offer from the France family-controlled International Speedway Corporation.
It's not hearsay, it's bull. That's the only word I can use. I keep hearing it and hearing it and hearing it. So after a while, you know, you get tired saying hearsay or a rumor. That's what it is.
And before the pit stop, Kevin Harvick flew into Pocono today after practicing at the Kentucky Speedway last night, getting ready for the Busch race there on Saturday evening. The BGN point leader will fly back and forth twice more before the weekend is over. In that practice, Jeffrey Bodine, Marty Houston, and Jeff Fuller crashed, totaling their cars.
If you're one of the many Americans who can't get credit, you can now earn a major bank card. We guarantee you a Credit Plus card with a $2,500 line of credit so you can catalog shop from your home. This program lets you establish or rebuild your credit and earn a major bank card. Call 1-800-270-6093. If you're over 18 and have a valid bank account, you qualify. There's no security deposit, no credit check. So call for your $2,500 credit card today. 1-800-270-6093. That's 1-800-270-6093.
This is two-time Pocono winner Jeremy Mayfield, and you're listening to PRN's Garage Pass.
G-Max Micro Lubricant.
It was just so simple. I didn't have to measure. It was just three easy bottles.
I got the power back. I got the speed back.
It just conditions everything, gives you extra gas mileage.
It seems like it has more power going uphill.
Putting the G-Max in is like putting a new engine in my van. G-Max, it's the best.
And one thing about G-Max, it helped DJ Ford win the Indy 500.
Take your mileage to the max. Take your protection to the max. Take your savings to the max. G-Max pays you to use it.
A year ago, Jeremy Mayfield pulled a move out of Dale Earnhardt's bag of tricks to beat the seven-time champion, nudging him out of the way, coming out of the final turn to claim his second win here at Pocono. Mayfield told us the two bumped into each other again the next week.
He walks by and in driver's meeting, I feel somebody just kind of smiling outside the hill, but it kind of just tapped me, you know. Man, who's that? You know, Grant Earnhardt. He walks by smiling, and that's his way of saying, hey, we're cool, you know, everything's all right, and I respect that. I mean, it's like, there again, that race will always probably be the number one moment.
That's it for now. I'm Mark Carroll.
PRN's Garage Pass, brought to you by Performance Friction. Virtually everyone in racing uses Performance Friction brakes. And by Crystal Clear at 1-800-270-6093.
Yes, I don't know what I enjoy more, the NASCAR update or the American ads. But also in America this weekend, the Kart FedEx Championship will be racing in Detroit. And if you listen to the Honda technicians and their Champ Car drivers, they'll tell you that the pop-off valve spacer that Kart mandated at the beginning of this weekend has cost them a lot of horsepower. And there's been a whole lot of fuss about different manufacturers having more track time than others and what impact that may have on their development for this weekend, and all sorts of threats of legal action. But anyway, they're going to sort it out on the track where they should be doing it. But all of that aside, three of the top four places on the grid for Sunday's Detroit Grand Prix, which is round eight of the Kart Championship, will be filled by Honda-powered cars. So really they don't have a whole lot to complain about. This Detroit track is more of a handling and setups track rather than outright horsepower anyway. And it was Helio Castroneves who took his third pole of 2001 season, and he's having a pretty great season, having won the Indy 500 just a few weeks ago. And of course it was his Penske Racing Team teammate Jules Deferrin who was close behind in third place. It was a Toyota-powered Bruno Junquera who managed the other front row spot, while Deferrin will be joined on the second row by fellow Honda driver Dario Franchitti. Helio Castroneves explained shortly after practice the importance of qualifying on that front spot.
Very, very much, because of so tough to pass here. But again, it's a long race. I mean, probably the heat's going to be a factor. So so far, let's celebrate. But tomorrow, let's keep cool. I hope I high-five tomorrow, actually. That's the important day. I mean, today is only 1 point, but it's very important for the championship. And again, we have to enjoy the moment today, but tomorrow have to keep cool and make sure that we do it again.
So having a look at the qualifying positions, in first, Helio Castroneves from Bruno Junquera, third, Jules Deferrin from Dario Franchitti, fifth, Jimmy Vasso, who's having a great year in Patrick Racing after having been dumped by Target Ganassi last year. Sixth position will be Patrick Carpentier from Roberto Moreno, Christian Fittipaldi, Nakano in ninth, and Kenny Brack in tenth. Some of the people outside the top 10 who you'd expect to be doing a bit better, 13th finds Michael Andretti,
16th, Alex Zanardi, and Paul Tracy, who had some problems during qualifying, was way back in 23rd. Another driver who had problems during qualifying was Tony Kanaan. Mo Nunn Racing has withdrawn his entry for this weekend's race after he suffered mild concussion in an accident during qualifying. Kanaan spun in turn 10 into the tyre wall, four laps into Saturday's 30-minute Group 2 qualifying session after his car appeared to make contact with the car of Max Pappas. Kanaan continued the session in his backup car, but in the five timed laps could achieve only 26 fastest time. The Brazilian visited the CART Medical Centre immediately after the session, complaining of headaches. The CART doctors sent him to the Detroit hospital for a precautionary CAT scan, which was negative. Doctors, however, diagnosed him with a mild concussion and advised him not to race. Kanaan is currently ninth in the points standings and expected to return to action in the next weekend for round 8 at Portland, Oregon.
And now jumping across to the Australian Rally Championship this weekend was the Falcon Tyres Rally of Queensland, where it was New Zealand's Possum Bourne who scored outright victory at the 2001 Rally of Queensland, leading home the traditional rival Neil Bates during both heats. Bourne steered clear of the mechanical gremlins that have hampered the Impreza World Rally car during the first two rounds of the Australian Championship, while Bates could only look on as the Subaru driver demolished the field. In Group N, it was Cody Crocker who rescued his weekend with a Heat 2 victory after last stage dramas during Heat 1 relegated the production Subaru to the back of the top 20. Crocker powered over today's seven special stages to finish 30 seconds ahead of Ordinsky, who performed consistently but couldn't match the outright pace of Crocker's Impreza WRX. Ordinsky, however, did claim third outright for the event following Bourne and Bates. Behind the leading factory cars, a battle royale waged between the leading privateers for the final production car placing. Simon Evans finally overcoming Mark Thompson and Stuart Warren for the position. The 2001 Australian Rally Championship now heads to South Australia for the Cooper's Pale Ale Rally of South Australia over the 7th and 8th of July, the round marking the return to the southern state since 1996. Expecting very fast, smooth roads, the Rally of South Australia should be a true driver's event, with a large contingent of Victorian, Western Australian, New South Wales-based crews expected to make the return to South Australia quite a memorable one.
And we'll have our own local correspondent over there in Adelaide, David Langfield, will be covering that event for us. He'll be chasing around the forest for the 2 days, keeping us informed with what's going on with the latest rounds of the Australian Rally Championship. Well, last weekend we saw the Nations Cup and the GT Performance categories going hammer and tongs around the circuit here in Canberra, but there's lots of other things happening for them. They've got some racing planned for later in this year, and joining us now is the category manager for the Nations Cup, Steve Betts. Steve, your guys have got a great performance last weekend here in Canberra. They've got a couple of things looming on the horizon, particularly in relation to the Sandown 500.
Yes, good evening, Colin, and all the listeners. It's a very big calendar for Nations Cup this year, including the plans for the Sandown 500, which is going to be a spectacular resurgence of that race, I believe. And, of course, Procar Australia running four of its own standalone events this year, one of which is already under the belt at Wakefield Park, which was extremely successful, and our next one coming up at Queensland Raceway on July 21 and 22, which should be a great event as well. So, yeah, lots on the calendar.
Now, currently there's a little bit of controversy regarding the Sandown 500 with the possibility that there could be a two-day media test weekend at Mount Panorama for the V8s on the same weekend.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a shame. It's only a very recent possibility that's come out. I mean, we've had the Sandown 500 date locked away from late last year, and I guess the concept of bringing it to the Sandown 500 has been alive since earlier this year. And in all our discussions with John Davidson, the whole project has come together very well, and there's going to be some fairly major announcements on the race coming up very shortly. But it is a bit of a disappointment that the test and media day has been published for the V8s on the same weekend. We are obviously disappointed because there was an enormous amount of opportunity. In fact, I believe some deals had well and truly been done with some V8 supercar drivers to in fact drive in the Sandown 500. With our Nations Cup drivers. So I'm not quite sure where that is actually all going to end up. I believe that a lot of the V8 teams are saying they don't want it. From a cost point of view, it must be an horrendous cost to not only open the track up there, but also for the teams to virtually attend another race meeting. They've got to boil it down to, because the heavy commitment they've got already is quite demanding on them, and I think to throw another week at them is going to be something that's going to increase their costs a fair bit.
Well, that's right. If you look at it, if you look at bringing cars from all over Australia, a weekend which includes accommodation, all the track time, and it's time that basically a weekend that maybe a lot of the mechanics and so on are looking as time off to take a little bit easier before they get to those endurance races, that goes out the window for them.
Yeah, and I guess the principal thing that I sort of have a great difficulty with, I guess, is the reasons for doing it. I mean, the V8 supercars is a wonderful concept, and it's got some amazing events happening, and their exposure throughout Australia and what they're doing is really quite incredible, and I think every Australian, including us at Procar, can stand there very proud of what they're doing with V8 supercar. But there is a need for other things in this country, for people to see other sorts of entertainment, and that's what we're trying to do. But I guess the confusing issue to me is a little bit that, first of all, I do not believe the V8 supercar teams need to go and practice at Bathurst. I think those guys are so professional and are so well set up that going up to Bathurst for the week of the October event is all they need to do. From a practice point of view, I don't think going there on one day, and I believe the actual practice session is only going to be for an hour and a half anyway, I simply don't believe they need to do that. And the second thing, of course, is it's promoted as a media day. Well, if there is one category in Australia that doesn't need to actually expose itself in that way, it's V8 supercars. I mean, the publicity and the promotion that surrounds that category is fantastic, and the Vesco and the boys from SEL and the teams themselves have done a wonderful job of promoting V8 supercars. So I don't think a media day at Bathurst really is of any advantage whatsoever, because the publicity that surrounds that category is very, very strong anyway.
And I suppose in some ways the teams would say, well, if they want to promote Bathurst, one way to do it would be to have some days locally where they could get to their fans and sort of encourage them to go from Brisbane, Sydney or Melbourne to go to Bathurst, and they could do it easily as sort of a shopping centre launch or something similar.
Yeah, look, I think that that really and truly, I've had a lot of experience with NASCAR in the USA, and really and truly the NASCAR category over there doesn't need to promote itself going from one venue to another. In fact, you'll find most circuits in the US, whether they be a super speedway or a road racing circuit, do very little advertising about the NASCAR circuit coming to town, simply because it is so big. Everyone knows it's coming to town, and everyone knows the date it's going to be there, so there's very little to do. From the racetrack's point of view, it's literally open the gates on the weekend and they will come. And I guess Bathurst, to a certain extent, is very much that way in Australia. I don't believe that, all the PR and publicity is as much required as it would have been, 10 years ago. People know it's on that date, they know it's returned to its traditional date, and V8 supercars are such a wonderful product that I don't think all the advertising in the world is going to change anything, or a media day or a practice day. They will all be there.
Well, that's right. I think, I suppose realistically from the expense point of view, the teams don't need it. And, there's 101 reasons why potentially I'd say this probably won't come off. And if one of them is the main thing, that the teams will probably say, not interested.
Yeah. Well, we believe, from some of the teams that we know and I'm talking Nations Cup teams here that are in discussion already with V8 supercar drivers to drive in the Sandown 500. There are contracts and sort of commitments being made right up until, I spoke to another team on Friday, one of our own teams that have committed a very high-profile driver to race in it. So I think there's a fairly good chance that this won't happen, and we would hope it wouldn't, because we really believe that the Sandown 500 is going to be a fantastic race for Nations Cup, and if it has got some V8 supercar drivers in the event driving with the Nations Cup drivers, I think that will just be truly wonderful for motorsport in general. And that's the way we look at it, that it's not a disadvantage to the V8 supercar circus, if you like. It's just another event which is going to provide another motor racing product for people in this country.
Yeah, I think there's probably a lot of people looking forward to the Sandown 500 taking place with the Nations Cup cars and seeing something different in that type of event. Now, the other thing, of course, which is you're working on currently, is the replacement for the end-of-season finale which you had planned for Adelaide, of course, with the American Le Mans Series race
now not going ahead in Adelaide. The race they had possibly planned elsewhere, now not going ahead. No doubt there's a lot of discussion and planning going ahead to try and find a replacement for that venue, for that race meeting.
Yeah, it's a real shame. We think that the Le Mans series has a great future, and we were actually really hoping that that did come off for 2001. It would have been wonderful for Australia to also have that product as well, I believe, along with, you know, the Formula One race in Melbourne, the IndyCar Grand Prix in Gold Coast in October. I think having the Le Mans series towards the end of the year was another great advantage for the Australian public to see, you know, something else very big and spectacular in motorsport. But it, with that race now not going ahead, it has complicated things for us. It was our final round of all our championships were scheduled to race in Adelaide. And then, of course, when the talk of it going to Sydney arose, we were, in fact, going to go there as well. However, we have not let the grass grow under the tree or under the bridge or whatever they say. It's something we're out talking to racetracks now about hosting another round of our championship, which will be another standalone event somewhere probably in the November area, because there's very little happening in Australia in motorsport in November because the V8s are off to New Zealand. And we think that there's a couple of weekends there that we could, if we can nail down the right deal with one of the circuits we're speaking to, we'll have another standalone event for the Australian public to have a look at.
Well, I know that myself, I'm probably looking forward to seeing where it's going to be and when, so I can start making my plans to be there.
Sure.
But, Steve, thanks for joining us this evening on Inside Motorsport, and no doubt, when we hear what's happening, we'll be back in contact to see where the Nations Cup is heading with the Sandown 500 and the end-of-the-year event.
Yep, no, that's great, guys. I mean, the Sandown 500 will go ahead on that mid-weekend in September. I think it's 15th and 16th. So look forward to seeing you there and all the folks as well.
Thank you very much.
It'll be a great event.
Thanks very much, Steve Betts.
Okay, bye-bye.
Rally of Queensland got underway, and an interesting weekend it was too. Possum Bourne just shown how dominant that new Subaru can be in the hands of a truly great Australian champion. Joining me on the line now to talk matters Rally of Queensland was Neil Blackburne. And Neil, well, I think everyone was pretty surprised just how dominating Possum was.
Yeah, considering after the Forest Rally that Neil wasn't too far behind him in reality. And in the past in Queensland, in fact the last 2 years, they've actually dead-heated. They've scored a heat win each, which in the Super Series format gives them the equal win.
It has been interesting so far to see that Neil really is struggling with that Corolla, which hasn't had any factory development now for probably 3 years.
Well, that's right. I mean, he said to me after the event that the car's starting to feel its age and its lack of development. And the truth is that now, you know, the car is 4 years old, and the car he's up against is really the state-of-the-art gear. So, you know, he is starting to struggle in that respect.
Mm. Now, there is only really two contenders in outright honours, that is Possum and Neil, and with Possum now showing such dominance, you have to wonder if there can be anything done in this season at least that is going to make outright racing a little bit more than a cakewalk.
Well, the interesting thing is later in the year that Possum's actually going to change cars again. So a possibility for Neil is that he knows the car inside out and it doesn't tend to fail. So in especially Rally of Melbourne, where he's won for the last 4 years, apart from a freakish time when a Group N car won the event, I think Neil will be in with a chance. But he's still there. He's still not too far away. And in events where there's not such a dominant effect of cars that have better traction, they've still got a fighting chance.
Mm. Of course, in Group N over the last few years, that's been where some really great ding-dong battles have been fought. And
absolutely.
This weekend, it was Ed Odinski's turn to get over the young upstart in Cody Croker.
Certainly was, but it was a bit of luck on Ed's side. Cody had it all wrapped up on the first day. Even though they were trading second. And Possum Bourne, Cody's teammate, actually dislodged a large rock, which both Bates and Crocker had to avoid, and Neil managed it just, and Cody did. And apparently they travelled down the road for some way on two wheels and came back down, but they had a flat tyre and some deranged steering, and they lost a lot of time, and that handed Ed the win by virtue of a clean run both Saturday and Sunday for the Mitsubishi driver.
Mitsubishi have had an interesting year with Ed toing and froing with Cody, and it's also been good to see that a few more manufacturers coming into Group N, whilst they're not running with Cody and Ed at the moment, they are all the time improving.
Yeah, there were a few contenders on the weekend that made life interesting. In fact, another Mitsubishi driver in Sydney side, a 20-year-old Mark Thompson, with his mum Rita actually co-driving for him, would have scored fourth place on Saturday, apart from the fact that he rolled 13 kilometres from the finish and lost a whole lot of time. There's also Ed's new teammate, Spencer Lowndes, that was keeping them all honest, and that crazy Victorian driver by the name of Simon Evans in a pretty much undeveloped Subaru was up there all weekend as well.
Simon Evans certainly has made a name for himself since he, I think it was won the Australian Rally Sport News Junior Challenge a few years ago.
He wasn't actually in the Junior Challenge, but he was of age to do it, and he was driving fast enough to challenge for an F2 outright win. And then he graduated to Volkswagen Golfs, and I think we all saw on TV what he can do with those. But Rally of Canberra was the first run for the car, and Queensland was his second go. And if it wasn't for gearbox problems on Saturday, and motorsport's full of this, of course, Simon would have been right up there as well.
Mm. And it once again was another interesting rally. Any major tales of woe?
Oh, major tales of woe. Well, Rally of Queensland's run in an undulating part of Queensland around a town called Imbul. And there's always great stories of having to go flat out over crest and meeting things like cows and trees and rocks that are put out on the road. I spoke to one driver, a Perth-based Kiwi by the name of Stuart Warren, was driving his Group A Lancer, came across the crest of a hill at about 180 kilometres an hour and was confronted with four bulls in the road. And actually threw the car sideways, was looking through the co-driver's window, and at the last second realised there was a bridge in the middle of the road as well. And the cows parted. He went across the bridge and he thought, we're still alive, we can still keep going. So there are a few stories like that, but everybody avoided the cows this year. Last year there was one driver, local driver up there, John Goazaway, actually hit a cow at 160 kilometres an hour and was determined not to do that this year.
Well, Neil, everyone can catch up with your photos and reading throughout the Australian press, and of course, Australasian Rally Sport News, always featuring your articles as well.
That's right, and also I photograph and write for the official website for the Australian Rally Championship, which is www.rally.com.au. They can catch up with me there as well.
Well, Neil, thanks very much for your time this evening, and we look forward to having a chat to you in the rallies in the future.
Absolutely, look forward to it.
And all the team here at Inside Motorsport are, of course, very proud of local lad Mark Webber, who is the test driver for Benetton in Formula One. But, of course, he's not the only Australian who's getting his backside into a Formula One car. And Australian international young gun James Courtney will get his first Formula One trial run with Jaguar next week, apparently. Sources at Jaguar Racing confirm that Courtney is scheduled to take part in a three-day Formula One test at Monza. He will help the team's regular Formula One drivers, Britain's Eddie Irvine and Spain's Pedro de la Rosa, try out the latest round of design improvements for the increasingly competitive Jaguar R2. Courtney, who's 20, from Emu Plains in Sydney's far west, is due to have a seat fitting for the Formula One car at the team's headquarters in the English Midlands later this week, and he joins fellow Australian Mark Webber on the Formula One test trial, the most direct route to Formula One Grand Prix grid. Driving for Jaguar's junior squad at the moment, he won the opening three races of the series and is fourth in the title points in Formula 3. Jaguar Formula 1 chief Bobby Rahal admits he is grooming Courtney for a future in Formula 1 with the team. Rahal cites Courtney's pedigree of winning two World Karting Championships and last year's British Formula Ford Festival title as a clear indicator of his Formula 1 potential. So we're going to follow him with quite a lot of interest this year and throughout his career. That's right, and last weekend the British Formula 3 Championship, which James Courtney is racing in,
had their race, which was the first of the open international meetings, taking place at the new Rockingham Motor Speedway in the UK. Now, in that meeting, James Courtney, he scored himself some well-needed points, which jumped him from sixth in the championship standings up to fourth. As it was, he qualified in seventh place for the first race and finished sixth, and in the second race finished fourth behind his teammate in the J-Team, Andre Lotterer. As it was Japanese driver Takuma Sato who took two race wins at the Rockingham Circuit and is now 39 points clear in the championship to his nearest place competitor. As it was a race meeting where they'd had some pre-session rain, and the old story, wet track in the lead-up, then it sort of goes from being a wet track to a drying track, and those who could handle the changing conditions did well. Those who couldn't caused problems. Actually, one of the reasons why James Courtney didn't improve on his fourth place was the fact that in the second race, one of the drivers had a big off, brought out the safety car, and of course, the people who had tyres going off and so on had a chance to cool them down and could get going again. As it was, then not enough laps to make it up. So that's the luck of the draw, as they say, those safety cars.
Yes, and of course we saw last weekend the gods of safety cars come in and affect a few of the races at the GMC 400, a race meeting that all the team here enjoyed immensely, I know, and as if we couldn't get enough of it, some of us then went home during the week and watched it all off videotape all over again. And having watched it on the TV, it allowed you to pick up some of the parts of the track that you couldn't see when you were live. And you have to give credit to these guys. They were really trying. That part at the back door of Old Parliament House was particularly exciting. And also the off the State Circle curve and then turning right onto Flynn Drive. Some monumental brake lock-ups there as some of the drivers were putting on a particularly exciting dice for position. So, yeah, there's some great racing there. And sort of following up on some of that, it's interesting to see how some of the drivers held themselves during the pressure of a big race meeting like that. After each V8 round, the CAMS release a press release of those drivers who cop a penalty, and most of them we see quite live there at the track or on the TV as they come in for a stop-go penalty. But sometimes this press release is quite entertaining to see the sort of fines that are handed out, some $200, $300 fines for exceeding the speed limit. And if you get caught by a speed camera, you should be thankful that they don't have penalties like this. Rodney Forbes was given a $200 fine for exceeding pit lane speed limit. He was doing 43 kilometres and the posted limit was 40. So 3Ks, $200. Steve Reed got $300 fine for doing 46 Ks. But one of the most remarkable things that I found in here was that Mark Scaife was given a severe reprimand for incorrectly rejoining the fast lane and was in breach of the supplementary regulations with respect to exiting the pit lane. They had big yellow lines saying you cannot cross this as you come into the pits or exit. And a number of drivers were indeed penalised a stop-go penalty for getting it wrong on entry to the pits. But Mark Scaife, he's truly blessed. He was just given a little talking to after race one, the Saturday race, that he did quite well in. And really has to be asked why. We all hear the stewards and all of their explanation after Eastern Creek that they're going to be tough, but they're going to be consistent. And I think this is a bit of a chink in their consistency argument.
That's right. And, of course, this week as well, with something that we were aware of at the track is a particular incident that took place in the pit lane between Mark Scaife and Trevor Ashby following a race two collision, which involved Scaife, Rodney Forbes and Ashby's teammate, Steve Reed. And the fact is that they were relying on the Channel 10 video footage that had been shot in that area. And apparently because of the background noise and so on, they can't tell what's being said. I'm sure that if they brought in a couple of lip readers, they'll understand that anybody who is standing nearby can tell them well and truly what words were being used by Mark Scaife, and they're the words that normally get bleeped out. I'm sure there's plenty of people around who could act as witnesses if they bothered to ask.
Yes, I'm particularly disappointed in the behaviour from Scaife. Let's give him credit, and the HRT for the whole team. On the Sunday in the long race, they really did pull out something quite special to win the race. They got their car repaired after that race to tangle very well and had an excellent strategy and deservedly went on to win that particular race. But I think that the true measure of a champion is not just how they win events, but how they handle themselves when the chips are down going through adversity. And I don't think Scaife has had to put up with too much adversity in recent years, and now the pressure's on. He really is, I think, reinforcing some of his the perception out there, his reputation as being a little bit arrogant and not particularly friendly. And anyone who had a scanner and was listening into his conversation during race two, yes, he definitely needed the beeper on that conversation as well. He's not holding himself out very well for a role model to anyone's little kids, that's for sure.
Mm. Now, of course, a couple of things, again, this year, the same problems that arose for the GMC 400 last year. As it is, we get around the circuit fairly widely all over the place, and there were some problems that cropped up in last year's running event that have turned up again this year. One, of course, is the perennial problem with the PA around the circuit.
Sorry, Colin, I can't hear you.
Yes, the perennial problem with the PA around the circuit.
This year, let's give them credit, because they did take one step, and they did have the PA available on a FM frequency. Mind you, you had to really search to find out what that frequency was. Yeah, but they need to publicise it a bit better that it is available on FM. And that way, when you... Well, often you can't hear the PA because the cars are noisy, fair enough, and that's where an FM headset can really be helpful. But when the FM, or when the commentary cuts out at the beginning of race three, a lot of the fans were very cranky. I know the guy sitting next to me, he was really upset. He wouldn't be buying an expensive grandstand ticket ever again if that's the best they can put on.
Mm. And that was a problem. I suppose it's one of those things that does happen where you do have such a large perimeter area that has to be all wired up and the like. But, you know, the thing is, people are paying good money. They expect to be able to know what is going on the circuit. And that was one of the other issues that a couple of people made to me, was the fact that they were in areas where they couldn't see one of the super screens. They could hear the track PA, but the problem was that the PA commentary was based around what you were seeing on the super screen. So if you couldn't see the super screen, it didn't make much sense.
Yes, that's always a tough one, isn't it? You can't really squeeze many more big screens in there. There's just not the real estate to do it. You'd have to knock over some office buildings to put more in, and there's the cost. So, yeah, you'd think that there'd be a bit more of a happy medium where the commentators have to be conscious of the fact that people can't see the screens and tailor their commentary to, you know, suit both somehow.
Mm.
I'm sure it can be done if they take that mindset into their commentary booth with them.
Mm. And of course, the mention of the fact that the numbers were down this year, and that was the other thing that a number of people said. Again, in terms of the ticket costs increased quite dramatically from last year to this year, as distinct to, say, the Adelaide Clipsal 500, where they had frozen. If you bought your tickets before a certain date, the tickets prices were frozen to those of the previous year. There was a fairly significant jump this year, and that again caused a number of people to say, well, that's the reason why the numbers went down. Instead of bringing the wife, the kids, the family, it was just, sorry dear, it's just me going sort of situation. And okay, they've got to sort of balance out to get the numbers there and to get the revenue, but what they've got to remember is that there are a lot of other things competing for those dollars, and if they price themselves out of the market, they won't get the people.
Yeah, we have to point out that the ticket prices were comparable to a single entry for Eastern Creek, Oran Park, or whatever, $50 for general admission. Mind you, that trying to promote an event like this, they're trying to go a bit broader, Colin, like you're saying. Let's take the wife and the kids and make a family day out of it, because there are other on-track activities, the stuntmen and the parachutists and the jets and all of that. But at $50, it is a bit steep. $50 really is the enthusiast price. And when you look at the grandstand tickets, they're probably comparable to the Gold Coast, perhaps. But yeah, that $50 was, I seem to think that it was above the threshold for the casual fan, particularly if it's on the TV. $50 or sit at home in comfort on the TV where it's a bit warmer. I think if they really want to get the crowd numbers up, they have to cut the entry fee or have a TV blackout. The TV blackout would upset many people, but I think we have to watch this space. I believe that while they have released 101,000 for the crowd numbers, that of course includes all of the officials, the volunteers, the competitors, I think the caterers, the security staff, everyone. Later, they will be releasing what the audited ticket sales were, and I think that's going to be quite a bit down on previous year.
Mm-hmm. Moving on to some other touring car racing overseas. This weekend, we've got both the British Touring Car Championship latest round, which is at Mondello Park, which is the first time they've been back to Mondello in quite some years over in Ireland. And as well, there's the DTM taking place at the Saxon Ring.
As it is, Ivan Muller for the Vauxhall team has got himself a double set of pole positions for the races at Mondello Park taking place later today. As it was, Muller was very, very happy, but his Vauxhall teammate, Jason Plato, from whom he took pole in both races, was well and truly upset. Plato made a few disparaging remarks about himself, saying that the car was good enough, but his driving was messy, and the fact that he drove like a, and there's an English word here that means a certain part of the anatomy. So he's definitely not happy with himself. As it is, Muller was more very upbeat about his pole positions. He's saying that the car is very consistent. They had understeer that was on the car that they've reduced, and he's very optimistic. As it is, James Thompson and Phil Bennett also driving the Vauxhalls filled the other two places on the grid. So it's a Vauxhall 1-2-3-4 for both races. The Peugeots are Steve Soper and Dan Ease. They're also well off the pace still, and the Lexus of Kurt Luby splitting them in both sessions. So things are not looking so crash hot for the Peugeot team. In the production car class, it's Simon Graves in a Honda and Simon Harrison in a Peugeot who are the two top runners there. Over in Germany at the Sachsenring, it's Peter Dumbreck in the D2 Mercedes CLK who's on pole position for the races there, and he has Matthias Ekstrom in a ABT Sportsline Audi TTR now second on the grid, with Christian Albers in a 2000 person Mercedes CLK sitting third. Michael Bartels in a 2001 Holzer Opel Astra. Actually, that's probably the best performance of the season so far for the Opel. Interesting this race as well, the fact that a number of the big names for the DTM are missing as the drivers are competing at Le Mans. People like Lawrence Ayala and the like, they had written into their contracts when they signed on for the DTM, they get the Le Mans weekend and the test days and so on off from the DTM. The person who's really hacked off about their weekend is the reigning DTM champion, Bernd Schneider, who has qualified down in 20th position. He had off-track excursions in both of the qualifying sessions, went off-track, and basically ended up back of the grid. So the old story, hero to zero, but then Schneider is well known for having some storming runs from the back of the grid in the past, but I'd say Dumbreck will be the one that beat. I'd say if the conditions are wet, which it has been through Europe with heavy rain and so on, then I'd say Ekstrom in the ABT Sportsline Audi would be the one to keep an eye on.
Now, in all of the fuss last weekend about the GMC 400, one of the releases or announcements that was made that probably didn't get the exposure that it was due is that Neil and Rick Bates, they've secured Bathurst drives for Queensland 500 and Bathurst. And, you know, being twins, sometimes it's hard to tell them apart. So just to make things even more confusing, they've both got drives in different teams, and both teams, their partner will be a Cameron and a Cameron Mick. Neil has scored a drive with Cameron McLean in the Greenfield Mowers Falcon, and that'll be a good one to watch. Cameron's been showing a bit of speed there. He just needs a little bit more luck and a bit more consistency, and Neil could put on a good show there at Bathurst. Rick Bates, who of course did quite a few races last year in the Colour Scan Falcon, he will be with Cameron McConville in the Optus Commodore. Again, a team that's you know, not quite at the top there, but they can still put on quite a good effort at times. So a good consistent run we can expect there. And they're both potentially top 10 finishers, so that's something we'll watch with a lot of interest.
That's right, and I'm sure that'll do the usual thing for the officials. They can, if they need to get a little bit faster on, they just swap race suits and helmets and, oops, sorry.
Yes, the old switcheroo trick.
Very hard to get rid of with you know, literally identical twin brothers. Now, interesting, for those people who are interested in Le Mans and want to know where their top driver and car is, we'll let you know what some of the retirements are. Now, of course, this particular Le Mans was interesting in the fact that there was going to be a number of cars and teams, manufacturers back in to the Le Mans race, and amongst those there was MG. Of course, we've got Bentley back again. But if we just go down through the retirements and different classes, there's a Pilbeam Nissan from Rowan Racing. Well, it had an accident and is out of business. Chrysler Viper GTS of Equipe de France, they've had an accident. The Celine Ford S7R, which is the car which had Walter Brun in it from Conrad Motorsport, they had an accident. The Reynard Judd Q10 of Dick Barber Racing, which had a number of different drivers there. It's out with an accident. So obviously the wet conditions which they had overnight probably took a few people out. The MG Sport of Anthony Reid, Hughes and Johnny Kane, which is an MG Lola powered car, it went out with engine problems. The Porsche GT3 of Donovan and Co, it's out unknown. Those are the ones which are very interesting, you know, that the engine hasn't stopped or whatever, it's just unknown.
Is that like the Mercedes that went out a couple of years ago, went out and up over the fence, and it took them a little while to find it, so it's listed as unknown until they find the car?
Or is it missing in action?
Yeah.
We have, as well, the Audi R8 of Johansson Motorsport. That one went out with an accident damage. It was the car of Stefan Johansson and Tom Coronel. The Cadillac Northstar LMPE from Dam's team of Collard, Goossens and Bernard, it stopped. Yeah, that's interesting. It just stopped.
Oh, brakes work.
Yeah. The Bentley EXP Speed 8 from Team Bentley of Martin Brundle, Stefano Telli and Smith, it went out with a broken gearbox. The Viper GTSR of Paul Bomondo Racing, which had Jackie Ickx's daughter, Victoria Ickx, it went out with an accident. She wasn't driving at the time, so don't blame the female driver. The Dome Judd S101 of Den Blav Avis Engine Racing, which had Jan Nielsen and Hattori Kato from Japan, he went out with an engine. The Audi R8 of Champion Racing, which was a car that Johnny Herbert was in with Ralph Kellners and Didier Thays, it went out with an engine problem. Now, the Audis, we normally don't expect to see engine problems, but there's an engine problem for an Audi. The Panos LMP07, carrying the hopes of Australia with David Brabham, Jan Magnussen and Frank LaGorsch, it went out unknown, another one that's disappeared. And I'd say very likely the fact that its fellow team, Panos LMP07, went out not very long after with a major engine bang. So I'd say it could have been engine problems for both those cars, the new 4-litre Panos V8 probably not surviving the distance. The other MG Sport of Blundell, Bailey and McGarrity, it went out with another engine. The Lola Nissan of Rook Nighthawk Racing, which is the car of Hurtgen, Fairbanks and Gleeson, went out with a broken engine. The Dick Barber, Reynard Judd, of Didier Deradiger, Sasha Marson and Hiro Matsuda, unknown, another one of those great unknowns. The Callaway Corvette from Aspen Knowles Racing, it went out with a broken engine. The Chrysler Mopar LMP, Orica Chrysler, of Dalmas, Montagny and Sarrazin with an engine. The Ascari team, Ascari, which has Harry Toivonen, Lupberger and Collins went out with an engine. The Dome Judd Racing for Holland with John Lummers, Hildebrand and Crevilles went out with electrical problems. And the Saline S7R from RML Racing, which has got Johnny Molan, Lambert and McKellar, went out with a broken engine. So quite a few retirements there with broken engines, but quite a few unknowns, which is interesting.
Now, Colin, you read off the accidents as if they were just like minor shopping centre car park dingles. And of course, at Le Mans, an accident can be quite horrendous at the crazy speeds that they're doing down. It's at the Mulsanne Street, that's right.
The Mulsanne Street, yes. And of course, a few of those humps there, the accidents are guaranteed to be dramatic. And of course, the nighttime racing, when they do have accidents in the nighttime, quite usually takes the team a while to realise, you know, where the car is and where the everything is. So, no doubt for them, the accidents are usually big. They're usually horrendous. And, yes, we're not going to underplay them, but accidents at Le Mans usually are, in the definition of Darrell Eastlake, huge.
Because Mark Webber, after he had his accidents there in the Mercedes, he was quoted as saying he would not return. He just does not rate the track and its safety standards. He thinks that he rates his own well-being much higher than having a career that has a couple of wins at Le Mans.
Mm. As it is, the Audis from the factory team still continue to dominate with Frank Bieler at the front end of the pack. They've had a couple of mysterious mid-session pit stops, which could mean that the first little chinks are appearing in the Audi armour, comparing the fact that their other privateer team cars went off with damaged engines. As it is, in behind them, but some 12 laps down in third place is the Bentley, now the sole remaining Bentley, which is being driven at this point in time by Andy Wallace. And then in fourth place is a Chrysler Mopar, which is being driven by Olivia Beretta. And then there's a Cadillac in fifth place, further 3 laps down. So things definitely looking interesting over there at Le Mans. We'll have to wait next week to see who the eventual winner is, because it does go through till quite late tonight our time here in Australia, but by the time most people get around to listen to this on their internet version, it'll be have been run and won.
Yes, that's right. We'll bring you all of the results and stories from Le Mans next week in the show. And just have a quick look through the calendar of what other exciting things are on. We already have spoken about the racing tonight in NASCAR and CART, but running down the calendar for next weekend, the V8 touring cars are over in Western Australia. And on Saturday night, if you tune in to v8x.com.au, you'll be able to get V8 updates from the team at Inside Motorsport. We'll be giving you some of the results of the qualifying. If they have a top 10, we'll have some details of that. And I do believe that they're going to have a race on the Saturday afternoon. Because of the time delay differences, they need to get the racing done so they can package it up for the TV on Sunday afternoon. So if you're busting to know what's happening there on the Saturday, it was v8x.com.au, and they'll have all of the news and information from Barbagello. Also running next weekend, Formula One in Germany. The CART and NASCAR are in this long stretch of the North American summer where they're racing absolutely every weekend. And for CART, it will be Portland, Oregon, and in NASCAR from Sonoma, and there'll be some superbikes on there as well.
Well, that's all from us in Inside Motorsport this week. We'll be back again next week with everything that's happening around the world and around Australia in motorsport. I'm Colin Ford.
I'm Peter Norton.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week.
Inside Motorsport is produced by Thunder Media in the studios of Triple S FM Canberra via Comrade Sat with the support of the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia.